Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN, and we are here on Tuesday, January 16th, 2018. We're going to recap the divisional round. We're going to get to a focused conversation on that infamous Marcus Williams play for the Saints later on with Matt Bowen. But joining me to recap the games as a whole is ESPN's Dan Graziano. Dan, how are you?
I'm good, Bill. How are you?
I am lovely. We have three games left.
Yeah.
We have three games left in
the
season.
Amazing, isn't it?
Does feel like it's simultaneously gone really quickly and been the slowest season in the history of the National Football League. And I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I guess you're probably right. Because you know what it is? Like, it bogs down on the stuff with, like, officiating and Ezekiel Elliott and all that stuff. And then you realize, like, you get to the divisional round and, like, three of the four games are just awesome. And you're like, yeah, this is why we're putting up with all this.
Well, if you're a Titans fan who was not particularly interested in Mike Mularkey, you might consider the fourth game to be awesome as well.
I guess that's true. The outcome got you what you wanted.
Strangely so. We'll get to that game in a second. Let's just go chronologically, just for ease of my brain. And let's start with that Falcons-Eagles game, which came down to the final play. And speaking of coaching decision, seems like Steve Sarkisian, who has not been the most popular person in Atlanta all season, did very little to create some new fans in the Georgia area with his play calling on that final series.
Yeah, I mean, this is what you get when you deal with the play calling stuff. This is what has always sunk sort of Andy Reid in public opinion, even though, like, Andy Reid's one of the best coaches, you know, of the generation. You watch him coach the final minute of a playoff game, say, how can this guy be coaching? And you forget all the other things a head coach needs to do. But, you know, in terms of Sarkisian, who's hired to be a play caller, right? I mean, the whole point of the Sarkisian hire was Kyle Shanahan's leaving, and we want to keep the offense exactly the same because it was so good, and we just need somebody who's got some skills as a play caller. And Sarkisian does, so here you go. Maybe not Kyle Shanahan-level skills, but still skills. And yeah, I mean, look, it will stand out, obviously, that the play calling let them down there at the end because, you know, you have a one-score game, you have the opportunity to win it, you feel like you're better than that team because they're running Nick Foles out there. Look, the Falcons had issues all year. Matt Ryan never played close to the way he played last year. So, you know, to focus in on one drive or 1 minute or one play probably isn't fair when we talk about the Falcons' downfall, but no, it's life in a big city if you're Steve Sarkisian or any play caller in this league.
I guess the tough part for me is not that I think Sarkisian did a great job. I just, so many things went right last year for the Falcons. They had their five offensive linemen played all 80 games.
Yep.
And we saw in this game the fact that they did not have Andy LaVitre really hurt them. The Eagles, and even last week with Aaron Donald in the wild card game, I mean, they just had very little in terms of an interior running game. Devontae Freeman finished this game with 7 yards on 10 carries. He did not have his best performance. And he, to be fair, he wasn't 100% either, but the running game was not consistently there for the Falcons. And there were just things about last year's team that even if Kyle Shanahan had stayed, would have been tough to repeat. I mean, this was, by all measures that I can find, the best first down offense in the history of the National Football League. And it's just, even if you bring everyone back in the same position, you feed them the same way you fed them last year, you get the same schedule, it's just not going to work out that way. There's just so many things that have to go right for you to be as good as the Falcons were on offense a year ago. So I think maybe part of it was higher expectations than we would have hoped for. But I think even given those high expectations, I don't love a couple of those play calls. I don't love the shovel pass. I think maybe it's, you know, I think shovel pass is one of those plays where if it works, everyone loves it. And if it doesn't, it looks awful. But that fourth down play, I mean, not splitting the fullback out because that's part of what NFL offenses do, but just cutting the field in half and just really asking a lot of Matt Ryan to get the ball out really quickly against that Eagles pass rush. I just didn't love the play call.
Yeah, there's a coaching axiom that says in big moments you want to trust players, not plays. And so, you know, obviously they wanted the ball in Julio Jones's hands, right? I mean, you know, Jimmy Chitwood wants to take the shot. Like, that's how it's got to be. So that was going to be the target. But you're, I mean, sports, it's just what it is. Like you're saying, last year, Julio Jones catches that ball and lands in bounds. That's the Falcons' 2016 season. This is the Falcons' 2017 season, and he doesn't. And I mean, you're talking about an inch here, an inch there. I mean, you know, throw that 50-50 ball up in the end zone for Julio Jones. you have reason to believe he can get it. Mm-hmm. And he didn't. And so that's how it ends. But yeah, to your bigger point, you know, they come in as the sixth seed. They have to play that game on the road. They played the week before. The Eagles didn't. They had injuries on the offensive line. They didn't last year. I mean, yeah, it's not just a matter of, I mean, we could break down the play calling on the final drive and yes, you know, they didn't give themselves the right options. And I disagree with you a little bit on the shovel pass. I think it looks bad even when it works. I think even when it works, you say, oh, maybe we got away with one there. What are we doing? Kind of like having Willie Snead throw a big pass in a playoff game instead of Drew Brees. We can get to that later. But, I think it's just a case of, you know, the fact that the Falcons, great year last year, good job repeating and getting back to the playoffs, but you can't expect everything to go right. And that's, I think, what makes what the Patriots do, you know, so incredible. Like to be here in this position literally every single year while the rest of the field changes around you. The Falcons are a lot more normal, than the Patriots are in that regard.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. And the fact that it came down to that final drive, it says a lot about the, you know, what the Falcons did in this game. They had that short field again from a special teams turnover, the third one they've had, in these two playoff weeks. So, I mean, they should have had the opportunity to kick a field goal to win that game. If they don't drop that Nick Foles interception before halftime, well, they can kick a field goal to win the game there as opposed to having to, try for a touchdown. And in terms of the Eagles in this game, you know, I was impressed with their defense, thought they did a very solid job. I don't think the offense wasn't destructively bad, maybe the way it had been in that Raiders game, for example, but I'm not especially scared of this offense given what we saw this week.
No, I think what we saw this week was a very good, very talented offensive coaching staff putting together over the span of 2 weeks a very impressive game plan, that was tailored to what can we do well. And how can we minimize the trouble that comes about as a result of Nick Foles being our quarterback in this game, right? Because, you know, no offense to Nick, he's not Carson Wentz. He's a backup for a reason. So they know his shortcomings,
right?
And what they can do to their plans. So that they, you know, lean on a run, run pass options. You know, you mentioned the way the defense got after the Falcons' run game. You know, find ways to control the game, not let that Atlanta offense explode on you. And I think they did it. And I think that's looking ahead. I wonder if that's repeatable against the Vikings defense, all kinds of things. But I think what we saw was not, you're right. It's not an offense that's going to scare you or light you up. But I think we've learned this year that Doug Peterson knows what he's doing as a head coach. I think we've learned that, you know, Frank Reich has some talent as an offensive coordinator. Maybe might should get a head coach look at some point. John DeFilippo, we've heard his name kicked around. This is a staff that did everything it could to make sure they were in position to win that home playoff game in which they were the underdog, as everybody knows from seeing all the rubber dog masks.
Have you purchased your dog mask for next season?
I don't think you can. I mean, I think they're out. Like it's the company we were just saying on NFL Live, the company that makes them is called Creepy Party, and they said they sold out, and then they ran a new batch, and then they sold out another one. So I wanted to get one because we had to do like the Hat Tuesday for NFL Live where you put the helmet on and say who you're all in on. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get a dog mask, but you know, we had the idea too late, you know, right? I don't think we'd go over to Target in Southington and grab one.
I was just going
to
say the Southington Target has to have them.
I don't know. They told me they looked, but.
That's why you got to go yourself. Can't trust those PAs.
Yeah.
It was definitely a smart game plan for sure. And obviously played heavily around the running game and around those RPOs, but very conservative. And maybe that was because of the wind. It sounds like it was pretty windy in Philadelphia, but I think three of Nick Foles' 30 pass, maybe of his completions, I believe. I forget the graphic, but 20 out of his 23 pass completions at the very least were within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage. So not much threatening downfield after that first play, which was, ended up being a pass interference call. Could have been a touchdown with a better throw. I'll be intrigued to see how they match up with the Vikings. I think that's going to be a game where we'll talk about it a little bit on Thursday. And we'll talk about the Vikings later, obviously, but a game where you would figure if either of those teams get down early by 10, 14 points, it's going to be a big ask of those quarterbacks to throw their team back into the game.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. And you know, the Vikings had the Saints down 17-0, and but the Saints had Drew Brees. You know, if the Eagles get down 17-0, I just don't know that Nick Foles is the one that pulls them out of the fire.
In terms of that underdog status, I mean, do you like the Eagles more now than you did a week ago? Do you think they're about the same as what you expected heading into that divisional round? Do you think they should be favorites against the Vikings in the NFC Championship game at home?
I don't think they should be favorites, no. But I don't think we should assume they're going to lose. I picked them last week, I can proudly say. If you look back at those picks where they put them in line with the symbols, I was the only Eagle symbol there. Somebody on Twitter said, good job, Dan, tasty cakes on us. And I thought that was nice, but I tweeted back. I said, I would like to know how to redeem this because I really like tasty cakes. So I don't know whether that was just an expression or whether somebody's really offering. Got to run that down at some point this week and see where that stands. But the Eagles have too many good players at too many important positions for me to think there's no chance for them to win this home playoff game against the Case Keenum Vikings. I think the Vikings are worthy favorites, but I certainly don't think anyone should assume that they're just going to roll in there and impose their will on the Eagles. It'll be a hostile crowd. It'll be a night game. It'll be a bunch of guys that know they're good and that have this underdog attitude about them, this nobody believes in us attitude about them, which is very dangerous. And I don't know who I'm taking in this game yet.
Mm-hmm. Now, granted, when you got that tweet, was it from the Wawa Twitter account?
No, it wasn't. I don't know who it was from. In fact, you know what? Kevin Nagandi answered back after I asked how to redeem it and said he would deliver them personally. So I hope that he's here tomorrow. Or I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to get my tasty cakes.
That may require
butterscotch crimpets.
That may require another trip to the Southington Target to make that happen.
They don't know. There's no way they're carrying tasty cakes in Connecticut, right? It's like
really?
It's a regional thing, right? It's like a Mid-Atlantic, New Jersey. See, we had them. I grew up in Central Jersey. We could get them there, but not too much further north, I don't think. I mean, unless that's changed in recent years.
I feel like I saw them in Queens growing up.
That may be.
It would not shock me to have them in Southington, Connecticut, but you have to go on a road trip to find out.
Yeah. Well, I'm right down the – I could just go right down the road here.
If you avoid that snowstorm. But if you're going to go in the snowstorm, make sure you get the tasty cakes in the snowstorm.
Yeah, obviously. How else are we going to get through a snowstorm?
That's a very good question. We're going to move on. We got Patriots and Titans to discuss, probably the least interesting discussion of the four. A game that pretty much went as you might expect after that first – couple minutes in that first impressive drive from Tennessee. It seems like the Patriots just sort of ran over them and got some help from the officials along the way. So let's start there. I mean, I don't want to get in the discussion of the officials are biased against the Patriots, obviously, but is there ever going to be a time where we're happy with the officiating when it comes to NFL games? Is there anything that you think can obviously change to make it a more palatable option?
Bill, this is a pet peeve topic of mine. I honestly think officiating is way overcovered. I think people focus on it too much. Mm-hmm. When we coach Little League, we teach the kids, hey, if the umpire says he's safe, I don't care what you think, he's safe. Mm-hmm. You don't argue, you put your head down. And then now the kids watch these games, and now every single time, there's a contested catch or non-catch, the wide receiver's hands go up looking for interference. Enough! Like, it's too much. We're like, this is officiating-obsessed culture. It's a game condition. It's like weather or bad bounces. If we could all just take a deep breath and go, hey, bad calls are going to happen. They happen both ways. We're going to live with it. But unfortunately, we're too far down the road. And one of the biggest problems, Bill, is this instant replay in sports, which is choking sports. It's choking the fun and the life out of our sports because we're so obsessed with every call has to be right. Look, either we're going to use human officials, which means there's going to be mistakes, or we're not going to use human officials, which means it's all got to be computerized. But as long as the human officials are part of the equation, then I think everyone's got to take a deep breath and understand that sometimes things aren't going to go right. And as a team or a player, your job is to overcome it as you do other game conditions like the weather or a bad bounce here and there, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my feeling. That's a tip of the iceberg summary of my feelings on officiating and the way our sports fan culture is currently obsessed with it, which drives me crazy. I hate talking about it.
So you don't want to join me on the replay show on ESPN2?
I will join you on the replay show. Here's my position on replay. Replay in sports is an abomination and should be completely abolished.
That
is my stance on instant replay review in sports.
You know what? It's a defensible opinion. It's not. I don't think it's helping. I'd rather have it than not have it. I don't agree with you there, but I do think It would be better to not have it at all than have it the way we currently have it.
The important thing is to understand the perspective and the goals, right? If your goal is to get every call right, then obviously you need replays. And so when I write this or when I tweet about it or when I argue with people on social media about it, I'm inevitably told, oh, so you'd be okay with the Chiefs game ending on a Derek Johnson fumble return that wasn't really a fumble. My answer is yes, because what you're doing is you're making a small picture, specific argument to combat my big picture argument, which is that the priority, if you're the NFL at this critical time in its history when it's losing ratings and maybe it's not thought of as positively as it was a couple of years ago, the NFL's priority should be how much fun is our product to watch? How relatable is it? How enjoyable is it for our fans? And replay reviews make it less enjoyable. They are not fun to watch. They stink.
I'm happy we were able to get that on the podcast. I feel like when I've been seeing you tweet about it, I've been like, well, I gotta get this 2-minute rant here on the podcast at some point. So I'm happy we got it here in this Titans Patriots recap. I guess the other thing I want to talk about is the Mike Mularkey firing after this game and the whole sort of 2-week stretch that happened. And I granted, if you're a Patriots fan, maybe you'll be very angry about this, but we'll have plenty of chances to talk about the Patriots over the next couple of weeks, I promise you. In terms of the Titans' decision, I mean, let me ask you this. Do you think, number one, they should have fired Mike Mularkey if they had lost that Chiefs game? And number two, do you think that they should have fired Mike Mularkey given what happened over this 2-week playoff stretch?
I don't... The word should is a tough one for me because, like, I'm not in charge of the Titans. I don't know what their goals are and I don't want to impose my own personal opinion on it. So I'm not going to say should. I'm going to say, I think based on my information, that the Titans were planning to move on from Mike Mularkey if they missed the playoffs and probably were planning to move on from Mike Mularkey if they lost to the Chiefs. And so if that is the case, and that I think it's my understanding or certainly the impression I got, if that's the case, then I would say, as cold as this sounds, good for them for not letting one playoff victory over the Chiefs change their plan, right? Because if you have a vision for your organization and you feel like this isn't the right guy, what he wants to do is not aligned with what we want to do, we need another voice in there, we have somebody else in mind, then to let the outcome of one game change that plan, I think it would be short-sighted. So I think if you're John Robinson and Titans ownership and you bite the bullet, even though – you know, maybe a lot of teams would say, well, we can't fire him now. Look at that great win. Then I think that's probably the more responsible way to go for your franchise. And again, this assumes that they were thinking about moving on from Mularkey in the first place, which it seems that they were.
It does seem like that's the case. And at least the reports, or some of them have been that there was a disagreement between John Robinson as the general manager who wanted to get rid of Mularkey and ownership, which wanted to keep Mike Mularkey around for another year. And then it also seemed like there was a situation where they fired Mularkey and the initial reports were, oh, well, they're going to go after Josh McDaniels. And then it seems like the Colts are the favorites to bring in Josh McDaniels. And whether they have a promise, whether it seems like they are just waiting for him to finish before they sign the paperwork, it seems like he is more likely to go to Indianapolis. So does it affect your decision at all if you're thinking that 6 or 7 teams have already gone after head coaches before you hit the market looking for a new one?
Yeah, I think it inevitably has to. But again, that would be the wrong thing to guide your decision, right? I mean, like if you feel like what you need is a change there, then, oh, well, it's too late. We made the playoffs. It took 2 extra weeks. Now we're behind on the interview stuff. That would be the wrong way to change your mind, I think, especially if there are candidates you like. Now, I don't personally think the Titans made this move thinking they were going to get Josh McDaniels, which a lot of people connected those dots in the wake of the move Monday, including me. But then you make your phone calls and you hear sort of otherwise. I think they'd love to talk to McDaniels, but just the way the process is structured, they can't until the Patriots are done. So if you play it out, let's say the Patriots beat the Jaguars, the Colts can interview McDaniels again because they already did during the dead week. The Titans would have to wait till after the Super Bowl to do their first interview. So logistically, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense unless that's the job of McDaniel's dream and he's willing to risk losing the Colts job in the meantime while waiting for Tennessee. So, but you see that they're bringing in Mike Vrabel. They're bringing in Matt LaFleur from the Rams, who's a very interesting candidate. You know, hasn't called plays anywhere, but he's, he comes from Kyle Shanahan and I think, they're bringing in, Steve Wilks. I think we've heard Frank Reich connected there. So interesting candidate list, and it seems clear that John Robinson had some people that he thinks highly of and wants to talk to, that he thinks might be the better coach to help manage the next and critical phase of Marcus Mariota's development.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this is a fair process in terms of the coaching process? Do you think it should be changed?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the obsession is over, we don't want these guys to distract from their work preparing for their playoff games. Fair enough. But, you know, I mean, you see it in college, right? I mean, like, the teams change coaches all the time during the bowl season. And, you know, I don't know. I still feel like professionals can be professionals. But, yeah, I think it's an unfair process in some cases, to the assistant coaches whose teams do well. Right, I mean, there's no question that there have been instances where someone might have had a chance to get a job, but his team advanced too deep into the playoffs. Mm-hmm. I think it worked out fine for Sean McDermott ultimately, but the 15-1 year with Carolina, there were teams that wanted to get hold of McDermott and then kind of moved on while the Panthers kept winning and made the Super Bowl, and so they didn't interview him or they didn't bring him back in, and you know, so you can see cases like that where it affects things, and it seems like there has to be a way around it, but. The priority for the NFL and its teams is, hey, the teams that are in the playoffs need to focus on the playoffs. So the process has to be designed, tilted strongly toward that. And that's what they've done. They've created that situation where, they want to minimize the dreaded distraction.
The worst distraction's just a huge problem. I mean, what if, couldn't you just say, hey, you know, we have 2 weeks between the end of the Super Bowl and then the combine? Couldn't that just be the coach hiring and firing period, or is that too antiquated of an idea?
But then you're asking what? You're asking teams that whose seasons end on New Year's Eve to wait a whole month before even making a call? Like that's what's tricky, right?
That seems unrealistic too.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but it does seem like it's a weird process that can tend to be a little unfair and a little overstructured.
Is this do you think the Tennessee job is desirable?
Oh yeah, I think so, because Mariota. Now there have been questions about ownership, right? Like how much longer is that family going to own the team? What are they going to do with it?
Right.
And I would think any candidate would want to get some answers there, but certainly could in the interview process, I'm sure. But Mariota, I mean, I don't know how you feel about Mariota, but he seems to be very well regarded by people around the league as a high end quarterback prospect and a leader. And I think there's a lot of appeal to the idea of working with someone like that. They have some good young pieces on defense. The offensive line has played well, though it could stand to be a little better in pass protection. They could maybe tinker there. Derrick Henry certainly showed something against the Chiefs. And I think Corey Davis is somebody who obviously has a lot of potential. So I would think the Tennessee job is appealing. Nashville's a fun town, you know, if you're into music, you know, things like that, like Nashville, that'd be a cool place.
Are there a lot of NFL head coaches who strike you as people who are into music?
I don't know. Maybe. They're not allowed to say, right? It's got to be football all the time. But who knows? Maybe somebody might enjoy living in Nashville.
They should. Nashville's a great city. Yeah. The life you live as a civilian and the life you live as a head coach are two very different lives.
You're right. There aren't a lot of, like, you know, you're like, oh, we're going to do some game planning and then we're going to have some meetings and then we're going to go hit like a bluegrass joint.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe, have a couple of beers. Now, you don't hear that from a lot of NFL head coaches. Maybe we should. Maybe that would be a better place if we took away the replay and let the coaches listen to music.
Are those directly correlated?
I got all kinds of ideas, Bill. It's off season. They should bring me in. Competition committee or whatever committee.
I'll committee it up. You'll be on the music committee. You'll be on the prom planning committee for NFL coaches.
The fun committee. Bring fun back to the NFL.
Well, let's recap. I would say, this is just my opinion, maybe you disagree, the biggest upset of the divisional round, which was not just that the Jacksonville Jaguars beat the Pittsburgh Steelers, but that the Jacksonville Jaguars offense scored 38 points. In addition to the 7 points scored by their defense in a 45-42 victory over the Pittsburgh Steelers.
I think after the Jaguars beat Buffalo, I tweeted something about it's hard to see their offense outscoring the Steelers. And technically, I was right.
It's true.
The offense did not. But I was fundamentally wrong. in a much more important sense, I was wrong. Look, I was at that game, and frankly, just a quick tangent. My seat in the press box was right in front of Tom Coughlin's, mm-hmm. and you know, runs football operations for the Jaguars now, and it was beyond all expectations of how entertaining it was to listen to Tom Coughlin watch the game. I mean, I can't repeat half of what he said. I don't know what the rules are on the podcast, but certainly I couldn't on TV. If you had listened to just the audio of Coughlin during the game, mm-hmm. you would have said the Jaguars lost this game 250-0 because everything was awful. But look, they were amazing. I mean, they got out 21-0. Leonard Fournette is dragging like the entire Steeler team picture with him on these 5 and 6 yard runs. And I mean, they manhandled them, and they knew they went in knowing, like, they beat them 30-9 in week 5. Mm-hmm. They come in, they had total confidence that they were going to beat this team in Pittsburgh, and they just took it right to them. And look, I mean, yes, Big Ben comes back and they score the 42 points, and everybody said, oh, what happened to that Jaguar defense, 42 points, and fair enough. But you had the Steelers in desperation mode, mm-hmm. and his first 4 touchdown passes were pinpoint tight window throws and incredible catches. Mm-hmm. So, like, I mean, you know, that's the Steelers offense playing at a high level, one of the best offenses in the league playing at a high level in desperation mode. The story of the game was Jacksonville sort of being able to impose its will, and when the Steelers got back into the game and they needed Bortles to make a big throw, he made them. Mm-hmm. On third down, he was making smart decisions. You know, he would get knocked around and still figure out a way to check it down safely. Right? The whole thing with Bortles is, can he avoid turnovers? Mm-hmm. And he absolutely did. Commendable job by everybody connected with the Jacksonville Jaguars on Sunday, because that was an upset, whether they would agree or not. And they were, they have reason to say we were better than the Steelers this year. Took them out twice in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about this game and think about that final score, and it's 45-42. I mean, it's the Steelers were lucky to have it that close by the end of the game. They scored a touchdown with 1 second left, which was the saddest touchdown
right.
in the history of football.
That was the Titanic band on the Titanic, right? I mean, that was terrible. Anyway, go on.
And you had so many plays where it was, like you said, just a magic left from the Steelers on 4th and 9 or 3rd and 11 or 4th and 11 or 4th and 5. Like, you know, plays where the Steelers were absolutely desperate, where the Jaguars had basically almost come up with a stop. The Steelers, you know, their stars come up with star-level plays, and you don't want to take credit away from them. There was that really strange Ben Roethlisberger lateral to Le'Veon Bell for a touchdown, which I think I can only imagine Tom Coughlin's reaction to that play.
I'm trying to think. Let me think. What I don't know. Yeah, that was one of those, because there was times where you would wonder why he wasn't yelling. Like Antonio Brown's touchdown catches. Like, what's the guy supposed to do? He literally was committing pass interference, like got flagged for it, and the guy still made a catch. So I think there were times where you looked at it and said, this is just incredible players making incredible plays. Roethlisberger's instinct in that moment was incredible. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't, I mean, what is he doing? Oh, yeah, no, that was actually a pretty cool play. I wish I remembered the specific Coughlin reaction to that play. That's a good question. But I think because I don't, it was probably one of those where it was a more subdued reaction than I anticipated. Where he reacted, Bill, was when his own team did something. Like if the Steelers had a long kick return, like he'd holler, "Come on, Joe," you know, like to special teams coach Joe DeCamillis, who was not there. But like, it was that kind of thing. It was like, tackle this guy, what are you doing? That kind of thing. So it was more like that. But as I was leaving the press box to go downstairs, mm-hmm. Jacksonville was scoring a touchdown to go up, I believe, by 2 scores. And he was actually kind of excited. He said, "Touchdown, touchdown." I heard him saying over and over again, like he started to let himself believe they were going to win.
Was that the last one? The last touchdown for the Jags?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Cause then I went downstairs. It's like 4 minutes left, 3 minutes left, and go mm-hmm. downstairs to get on the field to do your interviews. So it must have been.
That was a play action pass, and a touchdown to a lead blocking fullback.
That's so the one.
If Tom Coughlin was ever going to freak out about a play, that would be the one.
Well,
right?
He just like, was like, wow, we ran that play? Oh, and it's a touchdown? Yeah. So yeah, it was their day. It was absolutely their day.
But you know, they deserve to win. And I certainly think that it gave you food for thought about the Jaguars offense, where they're never going to be the Steelers or the Patriots on offense, even though they scored just as if they were the Steelers or Patriots on Sunday. But you know, Blake Bortles was legitimately pretty good. He was 14 and 26. Those numbers aren't necessarily great, but he had a, you know, the throws he made were on time. They were in the right place. He missed a throw here or there, but when he needed a big throw, he hit it, including that deep post that set up that Leonard Fournette touchdown that really kind of broke the game open in the fourth quarter for the Jags, put them up 35-21 with 10 minutes to go. I mean, it was a sort of performance where if you watch that guy from a month ago, you think, oh yeah, of course, totally like what Blake Bortles has been doing. But the guy you saw against the Bills, I mean, that guy looked like he'd never played quarterback before. So it seems so assured from a guy who seemed so unassured a week ago.
Yeah, he was good when they needed him to be. I was talking to one of their coaches on Saturday. I was at their same hotel, coincidentally, and I saw them checking in. And you know, we were talking about the week before, and you know, it's got to be obviously Fournette and the line pushing him around. And he said, yeah, it does. He said, but we're going to have to try some different things. He said, we're not going to win this game with 10 points. Mm-hmm. So they knew they were going to have to ask more of Bortles in that game than they did the week before. The week before, clearly, they were scaled back. Let's ask Bortles to do as little as possible, other than running, which, by the way, he does pretty well. And I think they felt like they could win it without asking him to do anything. They didn't feel that way against Pittsburgh, and I doubt they feel that way this week. So we'll see what happens. But look, Pittsburgh's defense is not excuse making. Pittsburgh's defense without Ryan Shazier is not quite the same, and certainly against the run. And I think that enabled the Jaguars to use the run to great effect to build that big early lead. But it also helped enable them to go 8 for 14 on third down. Mm-hmm. I mean, which is, you know, one of the stories of the game. And again, in a couple of those situations, it was about Bortles making the right throw and the right decision. The Jaguars are built to beat you with defense in the run game. If they had a quarterback they felt more confident in, they'd be incredibly dangerous. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're sufficiently dangerous to be in the AFC Championship game, but I don't know that it's repeatable against, you know, the Patriots. Ruin everybody's fun.
Yes, unfortunately so. But we'll see. I mean, you know, if this team shows up again on Sunday, if we get the offense from this week and the defense from a week ago, that team can beat anybody.
I mean, it's not a great matchup for New England. I mean, the Jaguars can get pressure on Brady with the front four, and we all know what that means in the playoffs. When we've seen the Patriots lose in the playoffs on rare occasions, that's been how it happens, right? But I just don't know how. I don't know how they're going to score enough to beat the Patriots. I mean, the Patriots will stack the box, make them beat you with the passing game, and I just don't know that that's going
to
work.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. We certainly have a few days before we have to check out that one. In terms of the Steelers, some criticism of the coaching staff after the game, Todd Haley in particular for those 4th-and-1 calls, both of which failed, the pitch to Le'Veon Bell that was blown up by Jalen Ramsey, and then 4th-and-1 later on. Haley's contract has expired. Seems like he might be brought back. Even some talk today about Mike Tomlin, where reportedly some members of the Steelers ownership wanted to hire a new head coach. Any truth to that stuff, or any reason to think that Mike Tomlin's job should be in danger?
I don't have any reason to believe Mike Tomlin's job is in danger. I've been told that it's not. To the extent that any of those sources are reliable, I don't have any reason to doubt them. The Steelers don't fire coaches. I mean, they've had the fewest head coaches of any team in the Super Bowl era, and perhaps not coincidentally, the most Super Bowl titles. No, they believe in Mike Tomlin as their leader. I mean, he's not an offensive or defensive play caller, but he's a head coach. Like and all the stuff that goes on with the Steelers, you know, it's weird because there's a chicken and an egg aspect of all this, because people say, oh, all this stuff is going on in their locker room. Like, does that reflect on him? The way I look at it is the 13-3 record, in spite of all that, reflects on him, right? I mean, managing your team through inevitable flare ups and crises and all that kind of stuff is the whole trick for a head coach. And I think Tomlin's shown a remarkable ability to do it. There is this tendency for fans to judge the coach on the most recent loss, right? I mean, it hurts. Like, we like Andy Reid in Kansas City. He's not going anywhere, but fans are mad at Andy Reid for that game. And you know, I'm sure he understands why. But no, a big picture, I mean, Mike Tomlin's the coach of the Steelers, and if they were to let him go, I think he's the kind of coach that people would fire their coach to go get.
Mm-hmm. Me too. I mean, think about the playoff losses this year. The Chiefs, you know, some fans wanted Andy Reid fired. The Bills, fired Rick Dennison, their offensive coordinator. In the division round, the Falcons, people want Steve Sarkisian fired. The Titans fired their head coach. Steelers may lose their offense, may get rid of their offensive coordinator. Saints probably aren't making any changes. Rams aren't making any changes. Panthers are going to, or Panthers fired Mike Shula.
They did make
a change.
They
fired the offensive coordinator. Yep. So, I mean, these are the teams that are successful. These are the teams that are here in the postseason. So imagine if you don't make it to the postseason, how frequently, fans seem to want change. So it does seem like it's tougher to hold on to your job now than maybe it's ever been before in the NFL.
Yeah, it's a tough business. They always say it's a tough business, but, yeah, I mean, look, sometimes you wonder if teams make a change for change's sake. Sometimes you wonder if teams make a change to appease the fans. Mm-hmm. You know, you always have to wonder if we're getting rid of a guy, who are we going to replace him with? You know, right. You don't want to just change and then all of a sudden you're worse off. But I think the Steelers of all teams, maybe in sports, have demonstrated that they value continuity at that position. And I don't think that I'd be totally blown away if they made a change with Tomlin.
Well, speaking of things that totally blew us away, let's finish up with Saints-Vikings, a very exciting game that ended with a very unexpected play. Of course, the touchdown pass to Stephon Diggs. Before that, I mean, I was certainly impressed with how the Saints came back in this game. You know, it felt like they were really out of it for, oh geez, what, three quarters? I mean, they were down 17-0. Until a minute 18 left in the third quarter. I feel like they really weren't in the game. The Vikings were dominating, you know, leaving some meat on the bone perhaps with Minnesota. They could have maybe, you know, gotten a little closer, expanded their lead a tiny bit, but the Saints did just enough to stay in the game and then suddenly burst forward. And, I mean, obviously what happened in the last few minutes was crazy and almost unprecedented, but I think in the long run, I think we saw a situation where maybe there's reasons to be concerned about the Vikings because they couldn't hold on when they had that lead. And then when they needed to throw the ball late in the game, they did. They granted it worked out, but they really did struggle to throw the ball effectively against the Saints defense that was pretty tired by the end of the contest.
Yeah. I mean, look, I kind of like how I feel about Ben Roethlisberger's ability to come back and score those points on the Jaguars. I mean, Drew Brees is a first ballot, no doubt about it, Mount Rushmore Hall of Fame quarterback. Mm-hmm. You know, and the Saints are a powerful offense. I mean, they couldn't run the ball in either of their playoff games, but, you know, they had a passing offense that was fifth in the league as well as running. I mean, I guess I give the Vikings a little bit of a pass on giving up a comeback to Drew Brees. Mm-hmm. But, and again, you know, we don't look too far forward, but I mean, what's left ahead of them this week is, you know, would Nick Foles be able to do that same thing? We doubt it. I mean, I don't know what particular about that the Brees comeback would necessarily concern a Vikings fan going forward. You know, were there specific coverage breakdowns? Was there an inability to pressure him? What exactly characterized the Vikings defensive performance in the fourth quarter that didn't show up in the first three, I guess would be my question.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a huge pass rush in this game. Only two sacks of Brees, three knockdowns. And of course, Brees is so good at getting the ball out quickly. So it's really, you know, it's going to be really tough for teams to get a ton of pass pressure on him the way that maybe they did on other teams. But, I mean, the Saints, it seemed like their running game was clogged up for most of the day, and then, mm-hmm. you know, suddenly they found an exception. They found Ted Ginn for plays. They found Michael Thomas in the second half far more frequently. Alvin Kamara did finally get going and had that touchdown catch. It sort of felt like the Saints were really struggling at third down and then eventually kind of got things going. They had that fourth down conversion on that final drive to set up the field goal. And when they got into the red zone, they were effective in the red zone. So, mm-hmm. You know, the first time they were in the red zone, they threw a pick, but then final three drives in the red zone, touchdown, touchdown, touchdown. So they did eventually kind of figure out what they were doing, but it did take a while and the Vikings didn't do enough early on to sort of, capitalize on that.
Right, and I guess they didn't put it away, right?
Right,
exactly.
They didn't
build a big enough lead. So, yeah, I mean, look, when the Vikings kicked the field goal with, what, a minute 40 to go or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, we're watching in the press box in Pittsburgh, just didn't want to leave and miss the end of the game on my way back to the hotel. Mm-hmm. I said, well, they left Brees too much time, mm-hmm. which they did. But no one, when the Saints field goal went in with 20-some seconds left, no one said, oh, they left Keenum too much time. That was not a sentiment that was communicated outwardly, I think maybe anywhere. But, yeah, that was some miracle, man. I mean, you gotta give it to Keenum. I mean, look, this isn't, This is not a, you know, he's not a superstar, but he's played like one this year. Like, I mean, the numbers are what they are. Second in QBR, I think top 7 or 8 in passer rating. I mean, like, he's had a big year. And he made a big throw. I mean, that play was executed beautifully. And the Saints defense, are we going to get into what happened on that play with the Saints defense? Because
I mean, we're going to talk about it with Matt Bowen a little bit, but I'd like to hear your opinion.
Well, I mean, to me, and based on, you know, the conversations I've had about it, it seemed like, you know, they anticipated a throw in the 10 to 20 yard range.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why their corners were there. And so the safeties were back in the 20 plus range. Figuring that the Vikings were not going to attempt that deep a pass.
Mm-hmm.
And then so the safeties are in a position to have to make a play that maybe they're not as well equipped to make as the corners are. Now, my question is, why would you not think the Vikings are going to try to throw deep? Because if they threw it 10 to 20 yards, they weren't even going to be in field goal range, and they had to get in field goal range, which was apparently their plan. So that seems to be a poor decision in terms of a defensive scheme. And then, of course, it came down to the poor kid, Marcus Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever he was doing. Was he trying to tackle him in bounds? Was he trying to make sure he didn't interfere? You know, was he trying to get him out of bounds? Whatever he was trying to do, we know obviously he did not accomplish it. And forever and ever, he'll see that in his sleep or in his vain efforts to attain sleep.
Yeah. And the poor guy, I mean, he did come up with an interception of Keenum earlier in the game that set up the Saints to help take the lead. So it's not like he had a bad game. He just had a terrible play in the worst possible situation at the worst possible time. In terms of that play, I mean, from what I've read, and I haven't watched all 22 on this yet, so I would be remiss to say I know this 100% factually, but from what I've read, this is a play that the Vikings ran 4 different times to try and set up the, you know, a play downfield. And of course, this was the best example of it working out for sure. But I mean, let's say Diggs catches that pass and Williams tackles him out of bounds or commits pass interference, both of which are bad. They have the ball, I believe I looked it up, it was right around the 50-yard, not 50-yard, but we ended up at a 50-yard field goal, which granted, it's a Vikings field goal for the win. I'm not going to
say already made one.
Yeah, they made one. Right. So again, I'm not going to say it's a guaranteed lock by any means, but you know, I think it was a failing more on the coaching staff than on Marcus Williams. That's not true. It was a failing on both their parts. But I feel like putting him in that situation was a failing. And putting him in a situation where the best case opportunity was going to be, you know, allowing a 50-yard field goal just didn't really add up. And so I wonder, you know, I wrote about this on Monday. Maybe you have to look back and say, okay, they should have had a timeout to get their defense set before this play, get their pass rushers fresh. And they didn't have a timeout because they used their final timeout before second down, but then they didn't have those first 2 timeouts because they challenged 2 plays earlier in the game that were very questionable, and they challenged those because their TV was out in the press box. So strange things about how all of this seems seemingly connected, and how little decisions you make earlier in the game ended up playing a bigger role later in the contest.
Yet again, replay. Mucking everything up. Listen, yeah, look, again, you needed to have a cornerback there. I mean, look, if you assign your corners to an area of the field that was, the 10 to 20 yard range, you know, I guess at least you have a plan, but it's not a well thought out plan because, again, even if the Vikings complete a 12 yard pass there, they're not in field goal range. So why, and the Vikings knew what time was on the clock. They didn't have timeouts. They needed to get to the spot where Diggs was going up for the ball. So you needed to have somebody there to help you cover. You needed your coverage guys back there, and they didn't have them. And then, you know, boy, you talk about a play working out. That play works out if he catches it and goes out of bounds. Mm-hmm. That's working out. It worked out plus. Like, what do you feel like? You're Stephon Diggs, you land, and you turn around, and you see there's no one left between me and the end. Now, everyone's screaming at you, get out of bounds. You're like, nah, I think I'm just going to go ahead and win the game. I mean, what a feeling. I mean, this is why we watch these games.
Of course.
I mean, this is the thrill of it, to see a moment like that and the absolute joy and excitement. When you have high level athletes that accomplish something that goes beyond even their own expectations for themselves, and to see that bubble over, that's as good as it gets.
Yeah. It was awesome. I mean, it was a ton of fun. It was a great capper to a generally pretty exciting weekend of games. And yeah, I mean, I watched the play and I saw him make the catch and I thought, well, why is he turning upfield? He's going to get tackled.
Right.
And I thought,
get out of bounds.
But there's nobody there. So maybe someone, maybe they disappeared. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to take something away from the Saints. It was a great season. Their defense exceeded everyone's expectations, but, you know, it's a frustrating way to go. Think about that game a few years ago against the Niners where they were, you know, had a lead and then gave up a couple big plays and that Vernon Davis touchdown with 10 seconds left to lose there. So a couple of crushing losses, for the Saints in recent years in the postseason. We'll talk about that play a little more in a moment with Matt Bowen. But Dan, thank you so much for coming on today. Where can people check out more of your work?
Well, I'll be on ESPN.com all week. One thing we've been trying to keep updated is a running rundown of the draft quarterbacks. We're going to have an update on that on Thursday, just sort of the five big guys everybody's looking at for this year's draft. I think we're going to run that in connection with a Mel Kiper mock draft on Thursday. And then what else we have going on? We got a bunch of stuff lined up. I'll be in Philly for that game, for the NFC Championship game. Check out those Vikings on Sunday. And then, we'll be previewing the Super Bowl, whoever's in it.
So you don't have a pick yet?
No. Oh, I'll also be on NFL Live and SportsCenter on Wednesday on ESPN Family and Networks. I don't have a pick yet. No, I don't. It's what? Is it Tuesday?
Yeah.
The games aren't till Sunday? I don't know, man. You want me to make a pick right now? Like you put me on the spot?
Okay, do you have a Patriots Jaguars pick? You're taking the Patriots?
I think so. I'm trying to find a way to pick the Jaguars because I buy into this whole like Coughlin Patriots curse thing. Like, but I don't know if that's enough to make me put my name on that pick. I don't know. We'll see. You know what? This time last week, I had sent in picks with the Falcons beating the Eagles, and I sent my editor Dane Beavers an email I think on Thursday saying, "Hey, I want to change to the Eagles." Just because as the week went along, the more people you talked to, the more you heard out of there, the more you felt like the Eagles, I think they kind of got this. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. I'm cautious of making a pick too early.
It's very fair. That's a good philosophy, Dan Graziano. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It is always my pleasure.
Guys, NFL conference championships this weekend. And granted, maybe if you're a Jags fan, even if you were a super hyped Jags fan about this season, maybe you weren't exactly thinking you were going to make it to the AFC Championship game. And you know what? You have. Good for you. Good for your team. Playing great football. Deserve to be there. And you deserve to be in Foxborough this weekend watching them play, which, granted, I don't know that I would want to fly from the relative warmth of Jacksonville to the freezing cold of Foxborough, Massachusetts to see an NFL playoff game. But if you want to, and perhaps you should, this may be your chance to see the Jacksonville Jaguars play in the AFC Championship game for the first time in a while, you should use our partners at SeatGeek, because SeatGeek will make sure that if you have to fly to Massachusetts on no notice to go to the AFC Championship game, one way to save money and make sure that you're getting a great deal for the tickets you do buy is to use our partners at SeatGeek. SeatGeek will not help you fly to Massachusetts, but they will help you get great tickets to the game when you are there, because SeatGeek aggregates tickets from all over the web, and they use their deal score technology to rate them, so you know you're getting a good deal on the tickets you're buying. You're not going to get screwed. You're not going to be stuck on Route 1 in Massachusetts watching the game at a Papa Gino's with a bunch of Patriots fans. That's not going to happen to you. You're going to be in the stadium with great seats watching the game. And even better, if you haven't used SeatGeek before, you can use my promo code, which is Barnwell, and get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Do that. Just download the SeatGeek app. Use my promo code, again, Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Make a purchase on SeatGeek. You'll get $20 back off that purchase. So it's going to save you a bit of money. You're going to get great seats. You're going to enjoy the game. You might even be heading on your way to the Super Bowl. So check that out, whether you're checking out NFL tickets, MLB, NBA, NHL, all kinds of stuff available on the SeatGeek site. So give that app a download, give that website a look, and use my promo code Barnwell for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase today. All right, welcome back here to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, and when I saw the Saints-Vikings play on Sunday, I thought to myself, you have to have Matt Bowen on the show to discuss this. Of course, a former NFL safety, someone who focuses on defenses, defensive coverages, someone who knows this stuff inside and out much better than anyone we have on the show. So Matt, let me start with this. When you saw that play happen, when you saw Stephon Diggs going for that touchdown, what went through your mind?
Well, the first thing is, to be honest, is you know, you go back to the formation, to the setup of the play, and the game situation itself. So as a defensive player, you know what's coming. Okay, there's no timeouts left. They have to get out of bounds. So that's how the Saints played it. It's a two-deep coverage, right? Mm-hmm. It's too deep, and they basically shift it over another defender to make like a three-level look on the outside because that's what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. It's similar to a flood route, okay? We used to call it OVS. It meant outside vertical stretch. An outside vertical stretch means you have an underneath guy, which is a flat route, an intermediate route, which is like a deep out, and then you have the deep seven or the deep corner over the top, and that was it. So you know the route's coming. The coverage call, you know, if you look on social this week, everyone's questioning. The coverage call is fine, Bill.
Okay.
It's fine. To me, it's fine. Because if they do throw the ball in the middle field, you have another deep pass safety over the top, and you have a linebacker inside, you can make a tackle in the open field. Okay, that's your job as a defensive player in that situation. If they catch the ball in the middle field, you make a tackle, you win the football game. And what you cannot do is let them throw a deep out or a deep seven route, catch the ball and get out of bounds. Now they're going to take a field goal and lose the football game. So you're doing everything right. You have three defenders lined up, stacked up. And then it just comes down to, okay, what is my plan as a defensive back? And that's one thing that I don't think has been discussed enough. You know, when you go into this situation as a defensive back, you have to have a plan. Mm-hmm. A plan before the ball is snapped. That if you get the route you're expecting, what they did, what are you going to do at the point of attack? Are you going to make a play on the ball? Are you going to let them catch and tackle it? What are you going to do in that situation? Are you going to get there early enough? And if you go back and look at the All-22, and I did this morning, there's a couple things in there, okay? Mm-hmm. I think Williams is a little too deep. Okay, and I understand that. I understand that. There was a time, and this is back in 2000, and it's a game they replay all the time. I was playing for the St. Louis Rams in the wild card playoff against the New Orleans Saints. And I didn't play a bunch of defense. I was a special teams guy, but I got on the field late in the ball game. It was a third down play, kind of a big play in the game. And I played way too deep. I played a little scared. I'm just going to be honest. I played a little scared. It was a big moment for me. I hadn't played a bunch of defense that season. I played a little scared, and the guy in front of me ran like a deep curl. I thought it was going to be a post, so I started running, right? You know, I opened and ran. Luckily, the guy bobbled it. The ball falls on the ground. I get away with it. But I can understand that situation. You're thinking, okay, I cannot give up a touchdown. I can't give up a touchdown. So I'm going to play extra deep. And the problem when you play extra deep is now you're going to break on the ball and get much more of a distance to close. So when you do that, there's going to be a little panic. There's going to be a little panic. There's going to be a little panic, and then you get to that point of attack and you say, okay, what was my plan? What was the plan I was thinking about before the snap? Now I got the route I want. What is my plan in this situation? What am I going to do at that point of attack to win this football game? And I think there was some indecision there from Williams. That's really what I think it was. When people say he whiffed on the tackle, he did. He missed the tackle. It was a big play in the game. We all know that. But I don't think he was in the because of that indecision, Bill, I think he took himself out of position. And now he's kind of in that gray area. Do I hit him? Do I go up and make a play on the ball? Do I chop him down low? What do I do in that situation? I think, unfortunately, as we all know, the result wasn't a positive for New Orleans.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it wasn't like it was a play where he got his hands on Stephon Diggs and just didn't bring him down. I mean, he wasn't even really close. It looked like he tried to maybe, you know, undercut him as he went up in the air so he would you know, stay in bounds, but obviously it didn't work out. Let me ask you, I mean, I the part that confused me, and obviously you would know much better than I would, in terms of that three-level stack on the outside, what is the flat defender's role in that situation?
Well, think about it this way. You know, if it's regular cover two, the flat defender's role is to sink. Make him throw it to the flat. That's what you want him to do, right? Make him throw and tackle. And even in that situation, they complete the pass, where is he at? You know, the 45, minus 45 yard line?
Right.
I mean, who cares? Right?
Exactly.
You know, he gets out of bounds, it's fine, what are they going to have? You know, 4 or 3 seconds left, something like that. And, you know, you're going to give him another snap, I get it. But that's, again, you know, from a defensive perspective, that's why they run that route. That's why they run flat corner versus cover two. Why? To set some bait, to set some a trap up front for the corner to say, look, come down here and play this guy. We're begging you to play this guy. Jump the flat. Go ahead. And we're going to throw the corner route right behind your head in that deep hole. Okay? So what New Orleans does is they shift over another guy. So it's basically three deep on the outside. You have a flat defender, an intermediate defender, and then Williams over top of the deep half defender. There's a lot of things you could look at. You could say, and I think it was Crawley, you could say Crawley can get deeper, right? Mm-hmm. Probably can get deeper and then help on the deep seven route or deep corner route, you know, give some cushion to Williams. And then maybe he can make a play on the ball. I mean, there's a lot of things you can look at, you know, after the fact and say it. But when I watch the film, it just comes down to execution, Bill. It comes down to making that tackle. Making that tackle, and the game's over. And, you know, the narrative changes. Everything changes. Now we're talking about Drew Brees against, you know, the Eagles defense, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, it's amazing to me, and I've always said this about playoff football, because I've experienced it. Those games are so fragile. They're so fragile. You might think you have something in the second quarter and it's gone within 2 minutes, you know? You might think you have an opportunity to close out the game with a drive in the fourth quarter, and you can't get it, you can't move the sticks on third down, and everything changes. Everything changes. Not only that, the narrative of your season changes. Okay, and that's why it's great to play, and that's why the pressure is great. That's why everyone wants to play on that stage, because the stakes are so high. Mm. But these plays, these late-game plays, can shatter seasons, and that's what happened right there.
Sure did. Now, you mentioned, you know, your play, where like you said, you were, it was your rookie season. I think was your rookie year, correct?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
So, you know, obviously you're just getting to the pros. You're playing in a special teams role for a successful Rams team. And I'm sure you realized in the moment that, hey, you know, I was nervous and I did get too deep. Did that affect you in the weeks to come or in the following seasons to come? I mean, how long did it take you to kind of get past that, you know, that just that thought in your head of, okay, I have to get deep to worry about these, you know, the poster, the go-round?
Well, I think as you get older in the league and you start to understand what things are, because I'll be honest, you know, I was putting the game in that situation. I wasn't thinking about formation, alignment, wide receiver splits. I was just thinking, don't get beat, right? That's what I was thinking, don't get beat. You know, that would be the worst thing, national TV, and I get beat over the top and lose a football game on the playoff stage. Now, I'm not going to let that happen. That's the first thing. I'm not going to let that happen. Okay, well, when you think that way, then you're not thinking situational football. Mm-hmm. You're not thinking about your footwork, your alignment, the shade you have on the wide receiver, where your help is, what the front is. You know, are you running a stunt up front? Is the ball going to come out quicker? And what have they done in this formation in the past? You know, those are all the things you have to know going into a play, especially in a crucial moment. I was thinking about any of that. I was saying, hey, you know what? If you don't get beat deep, there's a positive. But you know what? It's pro football. You know, you can't just get away with that. And it didn't really impact me. And it wasn't a situation like this that lost the football game. You know, because I have seen the people say, you know, what's going to happen to Williams moving forward. Mm-hmm. But I've always said it's about football. When we're talking about the high school game where I coach, or college football, or the NFL, it is a unique sport, and it teaches you so many lessons. And these lessons, you know, that can only be found really on the football field, in my opinion, for these players. And sometimes the lessons are extremely, extremely hard. They're extremely hard. And they teach you a lot about yourself, and they put you in adverse situations. And I'm sure this is going to be a very tough moment for him to overcome. But you also have to say, okay, the play's over. The season's over. You can't go back and fix it. Mm-hmm. So what's the next step for you as a player? What are you going to do to learn from that moment? Okay, how is it going to make you a better football player? What can I do to say, look, this is not only going to help you in football, but later in life? Okay, because that's what this game really does to people, is it sets you up for later in life when you have challenges in your everyday life or business, family, whatever it is down the road, that you can draw back on these experiences. So, well, look, you know, I made a mistake that cost our team a playoff chance and a chance to go to the Super Bowl. You know, I can get through this. You know, so those are things you look at. But I don't think this will be a situation. And obviously, I don't know the young man. I mean, I can't. This is just my opinion as a former defensive player, that you look at this and say, this is going to make me better. This is going to allow me, once I start that off-season program, to be a better football player. You know, and the one thing I did like was how his teammates supported him. I love that. Because in that same game I was talking about, Bill, when we lost to the Saints in 2000, the next series, you know, when we stopped the Saints, they pointed out the team and he fumbled. Okay. I think, you know, that's been replayed a bunch. They, you know, when they kicked the ball, we thought, okay, we're going to go down and score. Kurt Marshall is going to take us on the field to win this playoff game. And Oz fumbled. And the thing I remember always, I was just a young player, was seeing Isaac Bruce, Torrey Holt, Ricky Pohl, and those guys go out in the field and pick them up. And for me, I thought that was the coolest thing. You know, this is a moment where everyone's saying, oh, you know, Oz put the ball on the ground, and he did. But it's not like he did it on purpose. He made a mistake. And it's just football. the end of the day, it's just football. Mm-hmm. And to see those veteran guys go on the field and pick him up, I thought was so cool. So that's what I liked this week, you know, coming off that game, is to see some of his teammates respond and pick him up and to speak highly of him and to talk about how great he's going to be in the future. Because you need that, too, as a player. You need the support of your teammates. You need the confidence in them to say, look, you made a mistake. You made a mistake. You didn't do it on purpose. You made a mistake. Yes, mm-hmm. It cost us a football game, but again, it's just football. There's going to be another season next year.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to have another off-season program, another off-season strength and conditioning, mini camp, OTA training camp. We're going to get back at this and do this thing together. So I really like that.
This is the guy whose interception really helped them come back into the game earlier. They wouldn't have been there without Marcus Williams. So.
And he had a great season. Mm-hmm. A great season. Coming in as a rookie and playing this league is hard. It's hard. And we see it all the time with multiple positions, especially mm-hmm. at wide receiver and in the secondary. I think that's the hardest transition for young players because the game's so much faster. There's so much more demands put on you as a wide receiver, and especially as a member of the secondary. And look what New Orleans did this year with Lattimore and Williams. That is amazing to me. Bill, that's amazing to me. That they could play at such a high level that quickly. I think it's really cool to see because that game moves so fast. You have to know much more. You're playing against guys who are getting paid a ton of money for a reason. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the best players in the world, mm-hmm. and you have to defend them. You have to stop them. So, yeah, he had an excellent season. He has an excellent season. And I hope that's talked about instead of just this one play. And I understand, especially how our business works, Bill. We focus on things like that coming off a game. That's our job, right? Mm-hmm. Our job to talk about it, to break it down just like we're doing now. But what he did this year is awesome, in my opinion. As a former safety, looking at that, I mean, compared to my rookie year, come on, man. I couldn't have done what he did. No way. No mm-hmm. way. And make all those plays on the ball and be a leader at such a young age. That was awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, that whole defense, you know, a lot of those guys are young. They are coming back, and they're going to be, you know, in place for years to come in terms of rebuilding that Saints defense there. Final question for you here. Did that play remind you at all in terms of maybe the coverage decisions or the, you know, the way it was defended perhaps of the play in the national championship game to win the game there on that go route?
That's a great question because I actually just went back and watched that play yesterday on tape, on the mm-hmm. All-22 tape, watching the national championship game. And there was similar things. You know, people say you shouldn't play too deep on that side of the field. You know, a 3-by-1 formation. The route there, we used to call it 999. Okay, so what it is, Bill, is it's 4 verticals out of 3-by-1.
Yep.
And if you count outside in, 1, 2, 3, number 3 on the strong side kind of drags across the safety's face. Mm-hmm. That's done for a reason, to try to hold the safety so you can hit that deep hole outside and cover 2. And again, everyone blames the safety, but there's a lot of things going on in that play. One, you allow free release outside. You're any time in cover 2, Bill, when the corner allows a free release outside, you're putting a ton of stress on your safety, a ton of stress, to get off his landmark over the top of that, okay? There's no disruption at the line of scrimmage. You're not buying your safety any time. No, I do think the safety had his eyes in the backfield. I don't think he was deep enough. I don't think he was wide enough based on the coverage. Mm-hmm. And knowing that, look, I have one guy to my side of the field. Yes, I can drive downhill on number 3 and make a play. Okay, that's my role as a deep pass safety in zone coverage. If he crosses my face, they throw the football. I'm going to drive downhill and tackle mm-hmm. and give us – then we have a chance to live another play. Okay, that's my job. But the thing I can't do is allow the deep ball outside. I can't. And really, in cover 2, Bill, the first – job as a safety is your eyes go to number 1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because number 1 tells you right now if it's run or pass. If you box the corner, it's probably a run, right? If he releases down the field, and if he doesn't break between 12 and 15 yards, that's where routes break. If he's not breaking between 12 and 15 yards, you better get going. Mm-hmm. That means he's going down the field on a fly route or a go route, whatever you want to call it. Well, is it similar? It was a little similar. Just the difference was is that New Orleans had a chance to finish the game just by a tackle.
Mm-hmm.
Just by a tackle. And that's kind of the cool thing I've always thought about football is we could talk, you know, I'm a big scheme guy. You know, I believe in scheme. I talk about scheme. I write about scheme at ESPN.
Mm-hmm.
But all the time, really, football comes down to fundamentals, simple things in the secondary. Your eyes, your angle to the ball, and your ability to finish play, whether it's making a play in the football or tackling. In that situation, it came down to tackling. That was it. Tackling, right? to angle downhill. You don't want to have hesitation. And I've always heard this. I had a BB coach when I was playing in Washington, Steve Jackson, who's one of the best. And he always used to say, when watching film, if you hesitated, he said, just believe it. Just believe it. Go. Go. If you're wrong, we'll deal with it later. But when you're in that situation, if you believe something, the defensive back, just go. Go make the play. Go make the play. And I think, ultimately, what we're talking about here was some indecision from a young player. And that happens all the time. It just, for Williams, it happened in a spotlight moment. And scheme was fine. In my opinion, the scheme in Alabama and Georgia was fine. Just comes down to execution, being able to execute the call and finish the play. And in both cases, that didn't happen.
All right, well, Matt, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people check out more of your work?
Well, over at ESPN.com. You know, fantasy season's over now, so I'm focusing more obviously the NFL playoffs. I'm going to have some Senior Bowl stuff coming up. I'll be down in Mobile next week for the Senior Bowl, and I'm excited, Bill. That, in my opinion, is the best event on the NFL calendar. Yeah. I love it. It's live football. You get guys in full pads and one-on-one situations. And my favorite thing, okay, and it always has been, and even more now that I've gotten into coaching, is to watch guys after they get beat. Because you're going to get beat, Bill. You're going against the top seniors in the country. You're going to get beat in one-on-one pass rush, one-on-one wide receiver, defensive backs, seven-on-seven team, whatever. You're going to get beat. So how do you respond when you get beat? That's the first thing I would look at as a scout. Because I know all these guys can play. The majority of those guys down there are going to get drafted. We know that. They're going to if they don't get drafted, they'll be in an NFL camp. They'll get a shot at the league. I want to see what they do when they get beat. I want to see, can they adjust their technique in that exact moment so the next rep they can win? Because they haven't played against these guys, okay, especially in one-on-one situations in a practice setting. When all the pressure's on you, when everyone's in the NFL, GMs, head coaches, scouts, are standing there on the fence watching you, that can make you a little nervous as a player. So I want to see you execute under that pressure. I want to see what you do when you get beat. Show me you can respond, first of all, mentally, okay? And then show me you can adjust your technique and go out there and compete and shut that guy down the next time. That's what I want to see.
Makes sense. And you're on Twitter as well.
I am MattBallen41. You know, I have some stuff later this week. I got something tomorrow about what I think Jacksonville should do. Not to stop Rob Gronkowski. I don't think anyone can really just stop the man. But how to limit him a little bit. How to limit him a little bit. And that's a little bit on scheme and even in matchups. And I'll say to you now, I think when the ball is inside, especially the red zone, but especially through the plus 10-yard line, I'm taking Jalen Ramsey and putting him on Gronkowski.
Interesting.
So I could watch this guy's tape all day. All day. I love how he plays the game, too. He has that confidence, that swagger. And anyone who watched the game the other day, the fourth down play, okay, Bill, everyone said, well, you can't toss it wide against the speed of Jacksonville. And I don't think it was a great call in that situation, fourth and one, to run like a crack toss. But the reason they made that play is because of Jalen Ramsey. And that goes back to what we were just talking about. Okay, if you believe it, go make the play. What happens? Wide receiver blocks down. What does he do? Immediately goes up the field and makes a tackle. The reason teams run that, Bill, against corners is they think corners are going to pedal or back up. Okay, when you pedal or back up, now you can pull that tackle and get him on a corner. That's not a good matchup for the defense. Now you're giving one for one. That's a win for the offense. You have to beat the tackle to the point of attack. You got to go immediately. And you went immediately and made the play. And I just think, look, I'm not coming down on the Jacksonville safeties. They're playing good football all season. But you got to take away the fade and the slant to Gronkowski and remove some of the formation in the red zone. Because if you don't, it's a touchdown every time.
Right.
Gronk's one of the most underrated route runners in the position. Okay? He's got excellent feet, excellent body control. He's a and at the point of attack, you know what he's going to do, Bill. He's going to push off. They're not going to call it. Too bad. You know, don't feel sorry for yourself as a defensive back. That's how the league works right now. So I need someone with the length, the footwork, and the physicality to challenge him. It's someone that's going to compete for the ball every single time. You're going to have to get the ball out. You're going to have to play the pocket and get the ball out. So my, and this again, this is just my opinion. I'm not running the Jacksonville defense. But in the plus 10-yard line, I'm telling Jalen Ramsey, you're playing cat coverage. Wherever Gronk goes, you got him. Go lock him down.
I'm excited. I want to watch this now. I'm hyped for this weekend. I'm excited for that matchup. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Matt, thank you so much for coming on today.
All right, Bill. Thank you.
All right, guys, thanks so much for listening to today's episode of the Bill Barnwell Show. Of course, thanks to my guest, Ben Graziano. and Matt Bowen. More podcasts coming on Thursday. We're going to preview these two divisional round games. So more football coming. Thanks so much for listening.